This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another special episode during these coronavirus days, coming to you right after the Passover of COVID. We've all been spending now a month, maybe more. I've lost track of time, alone in the house. And I recall something that I wrote a few years ago in Tradition about Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzedek Livracha, and his thoughts on the role of literature in religious life. Literature is something that helps focus our attention on matters of great import, but also serves to help us look back inside to the inscape. And as many people are trying to find escape in books, if their children will let them, I thought it would be informative to talk with my friend Sarah Ridner, who has taught English literature at Lander College for Women in New York City. More recently, she's relocated to Israel, where she maintains an active writing career, particularly focused on questions of the intersection of Judaism and Torah study and literature. And you can find her writing in a variety of platforms. But recently, she authored the first of what we hope will be many contributions to our journal in our symposium on Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's Rupture and Reconstruction. So, Sarah, I hope you and your family are well and weathering over this very difficult and, we must say, tragic time. We hope you're managing well. And tell us a little bit about what you're reading, what plague literature has made its way to your reading pile, and what are you finding there?
Thank you so much, Rabbi Sachs. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I've been finding my experience of this corona moment has come in stages. And at various points along the way, different works of literature have come to mind as helpful for processing what we've been seeing and experiencing around us. Early on, when the news was still early, and I wasn't entirely sure what to make of this threat, how seriously to take it, how much to change my own behavior. A story that kept coming to mind is Daisy Miller by Henry James, which was published in 1878 and depicts a family, a wealthy American family that's doing the grand tour of Europe and spending a long time in various European countries, particularly Switzerland and then Italy. And it centers around Daisy Miller, who's very beautiful, slightly imprudent young heroine, and her experience in the European social scene, which is contains people who have much more life experience than her, for better or for worse. And her and set against the backdrop of the story, especially when she arrives in Italy, is the existence and the potential threat of a Roman fever, which was apparently a strain of malaria, which was very much a threat, particularly in Italy during this time period. And also, you know, the story mainly centers on her own courtship with a young Italian man and also an American man who's interested in her. And what's interesting about the story is, in the beginning of the story, it's not really about Roman fever at all. It's about Daisy and the ambiguity about the nature of her character and whether the question of whether or not she's innocent, right, whether or not she's acting with higher ideals in mind or whether she has something a little more suspicious or corrupt about her. And this becomes the main question of the story. Is she an innocent or not? Until almost the end of the story, when one evening she's out with her young Italian beau, and he takes her somewhere where Roman fever is particularly a threat, and she ends up getting
the Colosseum.
The Colosseum, exactly. It's an evening time. It was a little bit more of a threat in the evening because it was transmitted by mosquitoes. And, you know, she's been warned all along by her mother that she should be wary of it, but she's not really thinking in those terms. Nor are the people who are supposed to be protecting her or taking her around. And then suddenly the story, which is really about a kind of, you know, just complicated social milieu and all these kind of interesting intrigues that arise in that setting, becomes a real life and death kind of story. And ultimately she succumbs to the Roman fever. The narrator, Winterbourne, decides, yes, she in fact was innocent. And as a reader, our whole orientation changes. And I was struck, and I continue to be struck, by how James is able to, I think, reflect on what a lot of us are experiencing now with our awareness of coronavirus, and how it kind of reorients us and changes our narrative when we think about what matters, what's worth getting upset about.
Uh-huh.
I think we've gone, I mean, I personally feel like I've gone from a sort of a certain kind of European novel to another kind. and I find that there's a way in which the story helps me understand my own experience in that regard.
Had Daisy only listened to the guidelines of the CDC and not gone to dangerous places, and it maybe worn a mask or covered up against the mosquitoes, she wouldn't have. Been,
I guess it would have been a more
have
boring
been
story.
By the malaria, but then I guess we wouldn't read her story. She wouldn't have become a fictional heroine.
Right.
So there is something about, you know, the tragedy, the human tragedy, the human loss in great world literature that portrays times such as these. And one only imagines what works. My daughter actually said to me yesterday, well, surely there's somebody already working on the screenplay about life in quarantine during Corona. And, you know, one day, if we merit to be healthy and to come out of the other end of this maze, we'll see those films and read that literature and music and poetry,
right,
and whatnot. But there is something about, you know, the kind of tragic genre of, you know, someone suffering through bleak times. You know, there's no end of every piece of writing that's been published online, mm-hmm, and already now in print, X in the time of coronavirus, which is, of course, some kind of homage to Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Love in the Time of Cholera. But what is it about that tragic setting which makes for good literature? I mean, we can think of so many titles. You had mentioned Daisy Miller. To me, it reminded me of Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, which shares certain similar tropes in the plot. In some ways, it's, of course, very different. Albert Camus' The Plague, which turns back the lens on, well, what happens to a society that's,
mm-hmm,
undergoing something like this. What is it about this story, you know, which in each and every generation has its own circumstances that makes for good literature?
I guess, yeah, that's a great question. To me, it kind of comes back to something Aristotelian when he talks about the tragic hero, someone whose fate is a product both of his own character flaws and also things that are beyond his control. I think that in modern life, our sense of things that are beyond our control are increasingly whittled down,
yeah,
as we live in an amazing world where so many of the, you know, challenges of the past have been overcome. And much of our misery in modern world is often of our own making, right? People create problems for themselves, and that's something.
In the Western world, disease doesn't.
Let's say
play
in the Western
same
world,
degree doesn't play
and,
doesn't play the same degree that it once did.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of literature that gets into that, and I find it really interesting. But at a certain point, I think it also becomes a little decadent. I think that something of this nature also forcefully reminds us of things that are outside of our control entirely. And then what we have in literature that depicts this, and again, this is also happening in life, but maybe literature kind of crystallizes our portrait of it so we can also see it around us, is the opportunity to appreciate and understand the range of human responses to these things that are outside of our control.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a relationship that goes sour because of your own doing and then you have to deal with it, that's one kind of story. But it's a very different kind of story than someone who's facing a fate that's outside of their control.
Right.
And the question of how they rise to the occasion and they deal with it is it's another kind of story. I think it also allows for some kind of heroism. It allows for greatness. Some of those stories can be really inspiring. Many can also be depressing, but I think that that's where, I think that's how these kinds of plagues are working in a lot of works of literature, and that's also something that we're seeing in our own lives.
Yeah. Of course, literature is of course, a great escape hatch. It's a way
mm-hmm.
that we can enter other worlds. I see one of my younger children during this time, you know, who is something of a bookish boy, a bit of a bookworm, really escaping into all types of works of fantasy and other things. And that's a wonderful, when one considers the mind-numbing amount of time that's being spent in less intellectually productive pursuits. And God bless you if whatever anybody needs to get through the day in these times. But, sure.
It's like a literary time, not only in terms of reading literature that specifically reflects on this time period, but just, you know, being home all the time provides you so many opportunities to read or watch films or kind of just enter these other stories. But it's funny, I find even sometimes in the works of escape that I encounter, it kind of comes back to what's happening around us. So All the Kind Family is a novel that takes place in the turn of the century. It's actually written in the 1950s, nostalgically looking back at the author's own childhood growing up in a religious Jewish family in the tenements of the Lower East Side.
My wife once described it as Little House on the Prairie, as Little House on the Prairie was for Yiddish speakers in the tenement, you know, if it was your bubby instead of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Yes, exactly. It's Little House on the Prairie without a prairie, without anywhere to go, really. and it's in two rooms with a family of five daughters. And this the book. It's a charming book with different vignettes in their life.
Serendipitously
got up to the chapter about Passover. And what happens in that chapter is besides for learning about their, you know, family's preparations for Passover, one and then consequently four of the daughters come down with scarlet fever. And that means that their entire family is put into mandatory quarantine. So the remaining healthy daughter can't go to school. No one's allowed in that apartment. No one's allowed out of the apartment. And the mother, in addition to preparing for Passover, also has to take care of four of her six kids and also can't leave the apartment at all. So obviously the parallels are striking. And most of the chapters, the family coming to terms.
They had to do it without the internet.
Yes. Luckily, Mr. Bosch, the grocer, somehow knew exactly what Passover items they needed.
without having to make a grocery item, grocery order.
Right. I guess things were a little less complicated back then. much of the chapter is the family, and, you know, it's the kind of thing, I don't even know who would have noticed it if we weren't in this time, period of time, but there was several, you know, kind of subtle reflections by the mother comparing the Passover she would have liked to have with the Passover she was having now, thinking about the guests she could have had at her table, the ways in which all the children could have contributed. But in the end, it was certainly not the Passover she had imagined, but it was also really nice. They left the door to the sick room open, and their four-year-old chimed in with Manish Chana from a distance. The remaining daughter offered to share her afikoman present with the other daughters who weren't able to come. And there was something really beautiful about the whole story that I don't think we would have quite understood or appreciated if we weren't in this very unique space and time.
Well, that's interesting.
And so I think even for young children, the literature, and again, it doesn't have to be a story that matches exactly, but these sorts of stories about overcoming adversity and making the best of an imperfect situation can be very soothing and nourishing and helpful for younger children who are also trying to process their feelings in this time.
Well, it's fascinating because I had asked about literature as an escape, and you immediately pointed something that, if I had made it up, you would have said I had overdone it. I put too fine a point on it. You know, a story which really does reflect a case, really a case of life imitating art.
Right. I think there's no escape. There's just.
Well, that brings me maybe to our final point, which is the degree to which literature, well, both for the authors, of course, as well as for we the readers, serves as a lens to help us think about ourselves, to think about, challenges
Absolutely.
That we're facing, to circumstances that we're facing, whether we look to something from the past, whether it's malaria in 19th century Rome, or whether it's scarlet fever on the Lower East Side at the beginning of the 20th century, or something more contemporary. How do we look to literature? How do we use literature? How do we gain the benefits of this most magnificent of human artistic endeavors to look and think carefully about our own selves and our own circumstances?
Mm-hmm. I mean, firstly, just to speak by way of contrast, I think that everyone's instinct these days, first thing when they wake up in the morning, before they pray, before they do anything, I think, is to check the news.
Yeah.
I think there's a way in which it's a sort of, when you have a rapidly unfolding scenario where things are constantly changing and, your own, rules of conduct also need to be changing, it's tempting to just be in the world of nonfiction and news, and it's important. It's not something to be taken lightly, but what these news stories never have is a sense of perspective and also a sense of encouragement, right? A sense of chizuk, like a sense of how you can kind of not only react or respond, but also uplift yourself in this time. And that's something we'll never get from the news. So if we're only consuming the news right now, we're really going to be missing something. And I think it's going to lead to a lot of anxiety. And I think what literature does, and again, it could be depicting all kinds of circumstances. We're in a unique time now, right? There's no way we're going to find it in a book. But by finding analogous situations, whether they jump out at us or we create the connections ourselves, and by studying and appreciating how authors and characters respond to those circumstances, I think we give ourselves the tools to kind of lift ourselves out of this and to grow in a process that's very, very difficult.
Perhaps we should end it with that and let our listeners go off and find a quiet corner and curl up with a good book and both escape as well as look back inward.
Absolutely. That sounds actually kind of tempting myself. but it was really nice to talk. Thank you.
In the meantime, we'll look forward to what you'll be writing, no doubt, on these kinds of topics. Thank you for your insights and wisdom on this difficult circumstance we find ourselves in. Thank you to our listeners. We hope to continue bringing you relevant content on the website of traditiononline.org. We hope also to be coming out with our spring 2020 issue, which should not be too delayed due to production challenges, and we apologize for the sound quality, which may be compromised, unable as we are to enter the recording studios at the Tradition World headquarters. In the meantime, we wish you all very, very good health.